Take your seats, Committee on Public Safety Policy and Finance, March 15, 2006. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland.
Here.
Cornish. Ellison. Hillstrom. Johnson. Meslow.
Here.
Murphy.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Newman.
Here.
Tamar.
Here.
Soderstrom.
Here.
Chair notes that we do have the presence of a quorum. We have some minutes in our packet. The first set would be Thursday, March 9, 2006. The motion. Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, I move approval of minutes.
Very good. Any questions? On the motion, then, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. And the last set of minutes would be March 14, 2006. They're also in the packet. Representative Meslow again moves approval. Any discussion of those minutes? If not, those in favor of approval, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. The first item we'll take up, House File 2614, Representative Newman. Registration requirements for offenders residing on tribal lands. While you're taking your place at the table, the agenda indicates that there besides yourself, there is one witness, Kenneth Peterson, Deputy Attorney General, State of Minnesota. Is there anyone in the audience besides the name I read who wants to be heard on this bill? Would you raise your hand now? I see no one. I'm trying to get a sense of time here. Representative Newman, see what you can do in 10 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Newman, Representative District 18A. Mr. Chairman, to begin with, if I may, I would like to offer Amendment A1 to get the bill in form that I would like to have it in order to proceed. And I would so move.
All right. That'd be D1 amendment, is that correct?
On the amendment? Mr. Chairman, the A1
amendment. A1 amendment, excuse me. Okay, on the A1 amendment, if there's no discussion to get the bill in the shape the author wants, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Any further amending?
No, Mr. Chairman.
All right, the bill is amended then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, House File 2614, as amended, is a bill that I have brought forth in direct response to a case that came down last summer from the Minnesota Court of Appeals, State of Minnesota versus Jones. This bill involves a question regarding predatory offenders. Specifically in the case of the Jones case, the Minnesota Court of Appeals ruled that Minnesota predatory offender registration statute is civil regulatory in nature, and therefore the state of Minnesota does not have jurisdiction to apply that law to Native Americans who are residing or where their primary place of residence is an Indian reservation. I brought this bill forward because I simply do not agree with the Court of Appeals on that particular case. It is my intention, members, to generate some discussion, and at the conclusion it will be my motion to lay this matter over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. It is my belief that the effect of the Jones decision is that the court has now created a safe haven for sexual predators on Indian reservations. And I believe that we have a compelling state interest to address that problem as state representatives. And the place for this issue to be resolved is in the legislature. It is not to be resolved in the courts, and it's not to be resolved by the executive branch of this government. this is the committee where this issue should begin in, and this is where it should flow from, in my estimation. In moving forward with House File 2614 as amended, I want to state that the issue has always been in this area, that a state has the jurisdiction to enforce a statute such as this if it is a criminal statute. If it is a civil regulatory statute, the state of Minnesota does not have jurisdiction to enforce it. And what has happened in the past is the courts have been interpreting these statutes of this type as being civil regulatory. Now, there's good and there's bad. If this is a criminal statute that we are dealing with, the state has jurisdiction to enforce it. However, if it is a criminal statute, then we do not have the right to retroactively apply it because it's an ex post facto law, and the issues regarding double jeopardy begin to apply. But we most certainly have the right to proceed proactively in the future with respect to sexual predators. The courts, the judicial branch, I suppose, would have the right to carve out some type of an exception to this law being civil regulatory and apply it similarly like we do with DWI laws. I have chosen to take this step. And I will tell you that it is my specific legislative intent to create a criminal statute which will apply, I acknowledge, in the future. And I will leave it to the Minnesota State Supreme Court, where this case now lies, and it won't surprise me a bit if this issue continue to move forward in the federal courts. But for purposes of the state of Minnesota, as a state legislator, it is my intent that we would be creating a criminal statute where we clearly, as a state, have jurisdiction and remove the ambiguity of the statute being criminal regulatory. So in that respect, I would like the record to reveal that it is my intention to create a criminal statute, that I believe that this statute would be penal and punitive in nature, in that the individual who fails to register would be subjected to punitive sanctions by the state of Minnesota, namely prison and a fine at the felony level, that confinement is one of the reasons why I am moving forward with this bill, confinement both to the reservation and in prison. It is my intent to extract retribution in the form of criminal penalties for failure to register, and it is my belief that we have, as a state and as legislators, a compelling public concerns, and that a violation of this statute would be in direct violation of the state public policy. Now, the reason I've used some of those languages or some of those words is because in case law, the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court have raised those kinds of issues, particularly in the Boughton case, which they utilize in finding that this is a civil regulatory statute as opposed to a criminal statute. And I am trying to lay the groundwork for future courts when they look at this, as I am sure they will, that my clear intent is that of a criminal statute. On to the bill itself, members. Essentially what this bill says is that if a Native American who is residing on an Indian reservation fails to register, there will be a court hearing, and at that court hearing, a judge will decide whether or not the Native American is in fact a member of a tribe residing on a reservation. And if so, the judge will then find he need not comply with the state's registration for predatory offenders. However, if you go on to page 2 of the bill, beginning at line 2.6, there is a specific travel prohibition. In other words, that individual will not be able to leave the reservation and re-enter the state of Minnesota if they have chosen to have the protection of the Jones case apply. Nevertheless, the person could sign a waiver, which is described at lines 9 through 0.13. Finally, the A1 amendment that I have attached simply indicates that a person who fails to comply with this statute is guilty of a felony. Subdivision 5 that the amendment is referring to specifically provides for a felony of 5 years or a $10,000 fine or both. So we are, I am attaching an amendment which addresses the criminal penalty. With that, members, I guess I would invite your input. A little dose of common sense, I think, would be helpful. And keep in mind that as you are discussing this, if we're going with strictly a criminal statute, we are going to have to rely on the Supreme Court to retain jurisdiction of those predators who came before this bill. If we approach this bill, and you will find in your packet a D1 amendment, which I have not offered, it's simply there as a possible alternative. That might be, I'm very hesitant, but it might be an alternative where this would be civil regulatory, and we are trying to direct the Supreme Court in the direction that we want to go, which I really don't have a lot of faith in. So, with that, that's the purpose of the bill. It's a complex question, quite frankly. And I will do my best to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Newman, we're going to be hard-pressed. The chair will be hard-pressed to entertain any discussion on an amendment that has not been offered to this bill.
I am.
Before we go to questions from the committee, strike that. Before we go to the first person who's identified as another witness, Kenneth Peterson, we'll first go to the committee and see if there are questions. Representative Ellis.
just a few, Mr. Chair. First of all, do tribal lands already have their own registration requirements?
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, not that I am aware of. And I will tell you that there is some discussion out there regarding an agreement between tribal governments and the state of Minnesota on... in effect, waiving this issue so that the state would have jurisdiction. And I will tell you that I sat in on the oral arguments before the Supreme Court about a week ago, and the issue of what you are bringing up was discussed. And I will tell you that as between the justices and the attorneys arguing this issue, they couldn't agree as to whether or not the tribal governments had the authority to grant the state of Minnesota jurisdiction. So that is an area that I would be very, very hesitant as a committee to go in.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to state for the record that this, I mean, I think tribal sovereignty is very important. I would just hope that we could engage, the state of Minnesota could have some dialogue about asking tribal lands to have their own registration requirements and maybe some sort of a reciprocal arrangement so that this heavy hand of the state of Minnesota doesn't in any way infringe upon tribal sovereignty, but we work with as opposed to dictating. Mr. Chair, I got another question, and the other is, Are there any constitutional problems with shifting the burden of proving of proof onto the accused? In the bill, it appears to say that the accused person or the person suspected of not registering would have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that they don't have to register because they're a tribally enrolled member living on a reservation. And I just wonder about the constitutionality of shifting a burden of proof onto an accused person and whether that would have any constitutional infirmity.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Newman.
Representative Ellison, that is precisely one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this bill forward. I think it's an excellent question. If the judicial branch were to ignore my plea that this is a criminal statute, clearly I think that we would have the right from a civil regulatory standpoint to cast the burden on the defendant. Could we do that if it is clearly criminal? Very, very good question. And maybe it is an issue that I would have to address and would do so while this matter is laid over pending possible inclusion. Good question.
Last question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ellison.
Representative Newman, have you thought about notice provisions? I mean, I think one basic of due process would be that the person who was suspected of not registering would have a right to be notified. What would notice be? Would it be personal? Would it be personal service of process on that person? What would the time frame be? Is there another provision in law that could be referenced to make sure that, you know, it's not a week of notice and that it's not simply a mailing or, you know, that they are actually notified as if they were being served with summons in a criminal case, given adequate time to respond. So, okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
Representative Ellison, my position would be that if it's a criminal statute, no notice is required, as there is no notice required, in my opinion, for violation of any other criminal statute. We are all responsible for knowing what is a criminal act and what is not. Let me finish.
Okay, sorry.
If this was a civil regulatory issue, that question has already been decided by the Supreme Court, I believe, in the Bowden case. I'd have to double check, but I know that it's been resolved, and I could get you that case.
Just a follow up, Mr. Chair. Representative Newman, I missed a hearing. And in Subdivision 2A, you referenced a hearing. And if you and I think it is well rooted in the criminal law that if somebody is going to be summoned to a first appearance in a criminal proceeding, that they would have to get some notice that the state does send the summons out. There is some, I mean, the person is given a fair warning that they have to avail themselves of the criminal process. Now, I don't think it relieves them of the burden of responding, but I think the state does have the requirement to send it to the last known address, and that there's enough time for the person to respond, even in a criminal proceeding. Now, if they miss it, a warrant can issue, but there is that notice.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, thank you. I misunderstood your question, and I would agree with that observation.
Representative Paymar, and then Meslow. Representative Paymar.
I'll wait until after we hear from the Attorney General.
Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Newman, an observation, and I just want to make a clarification. First, as to the issue that Representative Ellison appropriately raised in looking at whether it's appropriate to place a burden upon the defendant in a criminal case, there is precedent for that. We do that for defenses such as necessity or alibi, but one of the things we may want to look at is whether clear and convincing evidence is the appropriate burden of proof on that. And I would suggest that as we lay this over, that's one of the issues that's worth exploring as to whether that burden is at the appropriate level when we place it on the defendant. And then I just want to make sure that I understand properly, when you talk about prospective application of this as a criminal statute, you're saying that if someone is already in the category of people who would be required to register as a sex offender, this law would not apply to them. It only applies to the people who newly come into the category. Have I got that right?
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maslow, that is correct.
Thank you. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
All right. Kenneth Peterson, Deputy Attorney General, State of Minnesota. Have a seat.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ken Peterson, Deputy Attorney General. I've also brought with me Sean McCarthy, Assistant Attorney General in our office, who's dealt with a number of jurisdictional issues with Indian tribes very successfully, I should add, in terms of the state Supreme Court. And so I may ask him, if we get into some more arcane issues, I may ask him to comment on them.
Very good. Go ahead.
Our first of all, we endorse the idea of talking about this issue. This is an important issue that's facing the state. Whenever sexual predators are involved, and this decision coming down from the Court of Appeals was a very vexing one, very disappointing one, one that our office certainly disagreed with. The case is on appeal. It occurred in Cass County. We lost at the district court level, then went to the Court of Appeals level, where Cass County's Earl Moss, county attorney, represented and lost there, and then it was taken to the Supreme Court. It was argued last week, as Representative Newman pointed out. Our office has filed an amicus on behalf of the county saying that we do not believe this is a violation of this is an Indian jurisdictional issue. We believe it's a criminal justice issue, along with Representative Newman. A little background. This stuff comes out of Public Law 280, a federal law passed in the 1950s, which granted five or six states the authority to handle criminal jurisdiction on Indian reservations within their states. Those states were mainly those type of states like Minnesota, where the reservations are basically open, where in Minnesota, on all except two or three of Minnesota's reservations, maybe four or five, on the bigger reservations anyway, the majority of residents on those reservations are non-Indian. And it just made more sense to have the state have criminal jurisdiction as opposed to the tribes. We have two reservations in Minnesota, Boys Fort and Red Lake, are not covered by Public Law 280. The other nine are covered by Public Law 280. And one of the basic rules of criminal law is the federal government controls and the state follows. The relationship, and you remember your constitutional law courses, is that the relationship with Indian tribes is governed by Congress, not by the executive branch, but by Congress and not by the states. And so one of the consequences of that is that Indian law always has to be approached rather gingerly, because you're not quite sure where it's going to come out. The states are obviously a player. The federal government's a player. Congress is the one that can come in. The courts are play an important role in trying to decide, sort things out. But to the bill itself, we have concerns. We're not opposed to the bill or favorable to the bill. We do have some concerns, and our chief recommendation is to the committee is to not deal with this issue until we find out what the Supreme Court rules. We hopefully will rule within 3 to 6 months, and by the next legislative session, we'll be able to figure out exactly what the contours of the situation are. We can deal with it then with more knowledge, with more facts in hand, and what the court is saying. If the court upholds the Jones decision, which I sincerely hope they don't, and I don't think they should, then I think that some legislation may be appropriate. If they do strike down the decision, I don't think legislation would be clearly unnecessary. It may just be more confusing to those the regulation of sex offenders. Each of the question was asked about the tribes. Each of the, or at least it's eight or nine of the tribes, have passed ordinances dealing with sex offenders. I should point out that no tribe asked for this thing. There's no tribe entered, submitted an amicus, or publicly said they wanted to have jurisdiction over the registration of sex offenders. I've not talked to any tribal leaders or tribal lawyers or tribal representatives that wanted this issue. No one wants to handle registration of sex offenders. However, they have passed, and each tribe has passed slightly different ones. They've passed ordinances, and their police are enforcing it. I don't think that we've had any, there's not been any reports of any sex offenders not registering with their tribes or with the county where they're supposed to be. We don't think there's any danger of anybody. We do not believe at the present time there's a safe haven by any means on the reservations for unregistered sex offenders. It's not to say it may not be in the future, but at the present time, we certainly believe the tribes have handled it very well. As I said, each of the tribes have passed different ones. The Representative Newman referenced one type passed by Leech Lake, which basically used their powers under Public Law 280 to pass an ordinance, and their self-governance powers, to pass an ordinance saying that the jurisdiction over registration of sex offenders on their reservation lies to the state of Minnesota. The other tribes have passed other ones. Some have included banishment. Others have included a tight registration system. We do have, with the bill itself, we've not given a real close reading, and so I can't give you a line-by-line item of it. However, we do have certain concerns, or not concerns, we believe that there may be challenges, if it's passed, there may be challenges to it. The Attorney General does not want to get in the business of telling you what law is constitutional, which law isn't constitutional. However, we do believe there may be challenges to this law if it's passed in the form it is now. One may be in the freedom of movement, on and off the reservation, and the restriction of the reservations are considered part of the state of Minnesota, and the whole term of entering the state of Minnesota from the reservation is probably inappropriate, but that can be worked out. We understand that. But there may be questions on the freedom of movement. There may be questions of some of the criminal issues which Representative Ellison brought up and Representative Meslow addressed on the burden of proof. We have not looked at how this relates to some of the other cases that have come down on interactions with the whole sex offender law, if it may cause questions with our whole notion of keeping these people under civil commitment. We haven't looked at that. We are concerned there may be some unintended consequences that no one wants that could result from this. And Sean, do you have anything you want to add that I missed that you believe you?
Sean McCarthy, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Sean McCarthy. The one other unintended consequence here is Deputy Attorney General Peterson was just mentioning, currently our criminal laws and our civil laws in the state of Minnesota work together to deal with sex offenses and registration of predatory offenders. There's potential here for there to be some undermining of that. The Boughton case that was referenced earlier is based on that distinction between civil and criminal. Problem is, the same civil criminal distinction have different meanings in the Indian law context. Without an opportunity to review this more carefully, and especially without some guidance from the Supreme Court, we have the potential here to undermine what's the existing way we handle things in Minnesota for Indian and non-Indian alike. It could potentially undermine that established case law.
Very good. We're going to go to questions right now. Let me ask the first one or two. Mr. Peterson, in February, the Attorney General announced, and I have a copy of the press release dated February 7, the Attorney General announced that his office, that he had entered into a memorandum of understanding with six Minnesota tribes to share information, coordinate efforts to ensure that predatory offenders do not avoid registration. I believe there's reference that was with six tribes representing about three-quarters of the reservation membership in the state. Mr. Peterson, can the Attorney General, can you provide a copy of that memorandum of understanding to this committee?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are different memorandums of understanding with each one of them. We'll get them to you, though. With the various tribes, because they take different form. Can I comment on those memorandums of understanding, though? What they do is basically recognize the fact that that the tribes themselves have passed ordinances, that they have worked out relationships with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to change names. It's just basically it's a recognition. It has no real force of law. It's more only a recognition that action has been taken by the tribes and by the appropriate state agencies to track sexual predators to make sure they are registering on their respective reservation.
So, Mr. Peterson, then the written memorandums contain the statements from the tribes as to what they're doing, as you just characterized?
Yes.
And, okay, you said you would get them to us. It's my understanding that, the governor's office and as well as the Department of Public Safety have requested these memorandums, and they've not been provided.
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. If I were to recess or lay lay Representative Newman's bill over for a bit, could you walk back to your office and get those and bring them here right now?
I work downtown St. Paul. They're down there.
We'll be.
I've got a doctor's appointment I would like to make, but yes, we can get them to you as soon as we can. We'll get them to you. I'm not going to make a big thing about it. We'll get them to you.
Mr. Peterson, when we're done hearing Representative Newman's bill, and you leave, could you get those back here within a couple of hours after this hearing?
Sure.
You could.
Sure.
All right. We'll probably be recessing and reconvening throughout the day, so when we're done, I have an expectation that they'll be in my hands within a couple hours after this hearing. All right. Any other questions? Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Chair, I apologize for coming in late. I had a bill in another committee. What, which memorandums do you have, or cooperative agreements or memorandums with which tribes? Is Red Lake and...
Red Lake does not have one because they have... It's not covered by Public Law 280 under... We've never had any criminal jurisdiction over there.
And is Red Lake going to be covered in your bill, Representative Newman?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
Representative Cornish, my bill would cover, or the intent would be to cover all Native Americans residing on an Indian reservation.
Mr. Chairman, do you know if the tribal communities are going to testify today at all?
At the start of the hearing, Representative Cornish, I asked if there was anyone besides these two who wanted to testify, and nobody raised their hands, so it does not appear that way at present. Representative Paymar. Any further questions?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I just want to make one further comment. Failure to register, the weakness of the Court of Appeals decision is, the failure to register is a felony in Minnesota law at the present time. It is a felony. And that's what the Mr. Jones would be accused of being. We believe that makes it a criminal violation. That's why we believe the Supreme Court is going to rule in our favor, in the state's favor, and hold that these the state's jurisdiction holds it, not the reservation's jurisdiction.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, the reason I asked that question about Red Lake is because when I worked up there, we would be chasing somebody in high-speed chase. We'd have to stop right at the border. There was different laws for Red Lake about wild racing, different laws about fishing. There's ceded lands around Red Lake that you couldn't get onto or enforce the same way. And there's a myriad of regulations for tribal members and non-tribal members or non-Indians, and it really hurt the relations between the Indians and the non-Indians. And the more cooperation you get, like we've done on Leech Lake, and some of the more open reservations seem to help community relations between Indians and non-Indians. So I was hoping that Red Lake would see this and all the trouble that we've had up there, and when I worked around the reservation, a closed reservation there in Net Lake Bow, and somehow maybe come to the table and work out some type of agreement that would be beneficial for both, especially in this area, because anything that just the little simple laws, like we had to stop ducking at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they could go till after sunset, and just all sorts of things like that. A big issue like this, you'd think they'd want to talk about anyway.
Very good. If there's no other questions, Representative Newman, we will lay the bill over. for further discussion, possible inclusion in the omnibus. And Mr. Peterson has made a good faith, commitment to having those memorandums of understanding delivered to the committee. I think it would be helpful for this committee to see them, in as much as you're asking for us to advance and help you create a law relative to the issues that perhaps are contained in those memorandums. So, Mr. Peterson, I expect to have those delivered to my committee administrator on the 5th.
We're going to do it, Mr. Goodday, as soon as we can.
Thank you. Today? Mr. Peterson, today?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
If I may respond very, very briefly to the comments of the Attorney General's office.
Please do.
First of all, with respect to waiting for the Supreme Court to rule, I would not be in favor of that, and I would oppose the Attorney General's request in that regard. I don't know when they're going to rule. I don't know even if the case is going to stop at the Minnesota State Supreme Court. So I did oppose that request. Insofar as the issue of tribal laws and tribal registration, I guess my position is that we as state representatives have an obligation to enact laws that affect the state of Minnesota. And if the tribes want to enact their sexual registration system on their own, on the reservation, that's fine. As far as whether or not this law is going to be challenged in the court, I would certainly expect that it will occur. It occurs in other cases, and in fact, in the Jones case, it occurred. And the fact that we may be challenged in the court would not waive me off of this particular issue, and for that reason, I do wish to proceed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Newman. Ms. Peterson, thank you as well. We're going to move along to the next item, which is House File 3244, Representative Tingelstad, Task Force on Human Trafficking, etc. And I believe there's one listed witness, Linda Miller, if she could also come to the table. Is there anyone in this audience who wants to be heard on House File 3244 whose name I have not mentioned? Please raise your hand. I see no one else. Representative Tingelstad, when you're able, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to be before you here today. House File 3244 is human trafficking, and this relates to an issue that passed this committee and the legislature last year. And I've been involved in this issue, which is another form of slavery, basically. Some people say that more money is being made on human trafficking than on drug trafficking around the world nowadays. And I've been working closely with the College of St. Catherine, which brought together a group a couple years ago, and also with National Women's Legislative Group, which is looking at this issue and the national implications. So with that, this establishes the statewide human trafficking assessment, and I don't know if you want me to walk through the bill. And today with me here today, too, is Diane Cushman, who's been involved with this legislation and working with other states as well. So, Mr. Chair, what is your desire at this point as far as the bill? Yeah.
Why don't we shift to Linda Miller? Would you please testify?
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Linda Miller. I'm the Executive Director of Civil Society, which is a Minnesota nonprofit, which I founded 10 years ago. I am an attorney. I graduated 30 years ago from law school. I graduated with Senator Neuville. We are the recipient of the United States Health and Human Services grant, as well as the United States Department of Justice grant for services and outreach to human trafficking victims. And that is mostly the Department of Justice grant is only international human trafficking victims. we received the Department of Justice grant in conjunction with a grant that went to the St. Paul Police to enforce human trafficking laws. Ever since a former Attorney General Ashcroft stated that Minnesota is among the top 13 in the nation as far as numbers of trafficked women or men, we are realizing that we have a severe problem. There is data now because of our grant from the Department of Health and Human Services, which is being handed out, and I will go over that. I do want to say that with the Department of Justice grant, I have been able to also start the Minnesota Human Trafficking Watch, which is a group of individuals and agencies who are concerned, want to keep up on what's happening with the problem in Minnesota. And we have over 300 members. also, you will see that there's been a lot of press within this last week. The Star Trib, the Pioneer Press, and also NPR have reported on this. I have had the Star Trib article passed out to you because it has a nice collection of our data on the back. It shows the countries that the people are from, and it shows the distribution between sex trafficked, labor trafficked, and sex and labor trafficked in Minnesota of the data we have found. Now, this is Star Trib is based on our first 10 months of the grant, and now we've had 11 months of the grant, and the chart that this chart here is our actual data redacted for safety of the victims, but this shows the additional month. So this is 11 months of data, and it shows an additional 8 trafficked victims that we've found. We have been receiving requests every day for training, and I want to name some of the places so that you can see that everyone in the state of Minnesota is really concerned about this problem. We are scheduled now for trainings at their request to Purim Rotary, Crookston Migrant Health Services, United Methodist Women Annual Conference. We did that already in St. Cloud. The Department of Public Health, Metro Refugee Health Task Force, the Minnesota Social Services Association, Lamano and Mankato, and the two Catholic dioceses. Also St. Kate's, also Home Free in Plymouth. So this is just these are some of the 21 trainings we have scheduled now. In other words, this issue is snowballing in the state of Minnesota. We've been very successful in finding victims and collecting data. When we received the Health and Human Services grant with Breaking Free, we started monthly national talks to the 27 other groups in the country who received the grant. And then all of the data was analyzed 1 month ago, so the 10 months of data, and we came out in the top. So that is both because of our successful best practice method and because Minnesota has a severe problem. So This is an issue of that is snowballing. We have a Department of Justice grant. We have a Health and Human Services grant. And we need a plan. We need a statewide plan. We need a task force. And I want to address the composition of the task force. Since the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which was a federal act in 2002, the agencies found that that was mostly prosecution orientated, and they were not getting victims in to testify, and therefore there weren't very many prosecutions happening. That study, which I have, is a Department of Justice study, and that study said we need the involvement of NGOs. We need the involvement of non-governmental agencies because an internationally trafficked victim is threatened. One of the indicia of a internationally trafficked victim is that their documents are taken. And that is used as a control method. So they are illegal, even though they're brought in mostly on visas. All the children we know of in a good study were brought in on visas, and all of the sex trafficked, most of the sex trafficked are brought in on legal visa, but actually fraudulent visa.
Ms. Miller, let me interrupt you. You're giving a lot of information. It's all interesting. It may not all be quite helpful. You started talking a minute ago about the composition of the task force.
Yes.
The committee has the bill. It's on page 4 and 5. It tells us who the representatives are from which groups. Is this listing of members of the task force adequate to do the job that Representative Tingelstad wants done?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am. Simply put, are these mm-hmm. is this task force that you're proposing mm-hmm. adequate to do the job Representative Tingelstad wants done?
I believe so. There has been a Senate amendment, I believe, that added a representative from the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Okay. Representative Tingelstad. Further on the bill, I know I interrupted, and I do not mean to cut off the witness. However, I'd like to direct our attention to the adequacy of the contents of your bill in her opinion.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The action of the Senate was just yesterday, so, I mean, if it would be the will of the committee to add that additional position, that'd be fine. Otherwise, it would be an issue that we'll talk about in conference committee.
Representative Pingel said certainly a few differences would not hurt. It would
right.
give us the opportunity
yeah.
to talk in conference. Go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you for bringing me to the point, Mr. Chair. The point is that the composition as proposed in this bill of the task force, I believe, is essential and is based upon research and is based upon the experience since the Trafficking Victim Protection Act was enacted.
Representative Tingelstad, Ms. Linda Miller, thank you for your input, Representative Tingelstad. Do we have questions from the committee on anything before us on this bill? At this point, then, I think to close, the chair will, for the record, move the bill, be recommended to pass, but then we will lay it over on the table for possible inclusion. Further down the road. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Representative Tingelstad. We're going to move along to Representative Johnson J., House File 2600, Sex Offenders Required to Wear GPS Bracelets. I've just been informed, for purposes of your information as well, the one listed witness, Mr. Nichols, has chosen to not testify on your bill, on this bill, but at a later bill, before House File 2700, Representative Atkins. If that's the case, is there anyone present in this audience who wants to be heard on Representative Johnson's bill, House File 2600? Raise your hand at this time. I see no one, so you're on, Representative.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I will move House File 2600 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, tell us about it.
Mr. Chairman, this is a bill that requires certain released sex offenders to wear GPS monitoring or GPS bracelets. Oh, yes. I have an amendment.
What is that?
Thank you. I don't have it in front of me. I apologize.
All right. The H2600A1 amendment, page 1, line 21, et cetera. That's your amendment?
It is, Mr. Chairman. It puts it in the form that I would like.
Let's deal with that now on that A1 amendment. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Then 2600 as amended. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It essentially adds a word that we forgot to put in, supervised or conditional release. What the bill does is it will require level 2 and 3 sex offenders who are on supervised or conditional release to wear GPS tracking bracelets so that we can, authorities can keep track of where they are, in some cases on a nearly real-time basis and in other cases on a little less than that. There are two forms of tracking that you can use, GPS tracking that you can use. There's active and there's passive. Active tracking essentially sends a signal approximately every 8 to 10 minutes into a central computer, so you can literally keep track of where someone is going every 8 to 10 minutes. And if they enter what is considered an exclusion zone, then it starts keeping track of that in real time, or I think every minute, something like that. Passive technology says that they still wear their GPS bracelet, and it keeps track of where they are all day, but the signal is not sent back every 8 to 10 minutes. Rather, at the end of the day, they have to take the unit that they wear off of their belt and put it into a little transmitter that's hooked up to a phone line, and at the end of the day, where they've been all day is then downloaded to that central location. So it is not like real-time monitoring. It's after-the-fact monitoring. Obviously, passive is less expensive than active. What this bill would require is that all level 3 sex offenders who are on supervised or conditional release will be required to wear active monitoring. And all level 2 offenders who are on supervised or conditional release will be required to wear either passive or active monitoring. We've left that up to the Department of Corrections and the supervised release agents to make that decision, depending upon what they perceive as the threat of this particular individual. Also, everyone who is wearing one of these GPS bracelets will be assigned an exclusion zone or exclusion zones where they cannot be, such as if they are a child sex predator, a school, possibly a park, daycare centers, obvious places like that. For some that aren't child sex offenders, there may not be a lot of exclusion zones, but I would assume there will be, at the very least, with respect to a place or a person that they have that they committed a crime against. And there may be inclusion zones. I don't suspect that would happen that often, but if there are people who need to stay within a certain area, according to a judge, then they would have an inclusion zone. And what will happen with the active monitoring is if they enter an exclusion zone, the person sitting at the computer at the command center, for lack of a better term, will then learn of that. And they would then alert, I think our bill says local authorities, but we may want to have them also notify the supervised release agent. And that's something that we could change over time. We have two companies in Minnesota who currently provide this technology because we have a few offenders who use passive, who are on passive GPS right now. They weren't able to come today just because of a timing issue. So I wish we could show you the technology, but I can very briefly explain it to you. Every offender would wear a bracelet around one of their ankles that just attaches on and kind of locks on. It could be taken off. It could be cut off with a knife or shears or something like that. But then an alert is immediately sent that it's been cut off. And then they have to wear what is kind of maybe the size of a fanny pack on their belt or somewhere on their person within a certain distance of that ankle bracelet. And that is what sends the signal, kind of acts like a cell phone for the active systems and the storage device for the passive systems. And again, at the end of the day, then they send all that information in. There's a fiscal note on this. It's a large fiscal note. It's larger than I had expected. I happen to think it's larger than is reasonably necessary, but I think an assumption that fiscal note was based upon was that there's going to be a significant increase in work, and so a lot of new people are going to have to be hired because there will be a lot of false alarms. In other words, somebody who has an exclusion zone of a school drives past a corner and is in that exclusion zone for 3 seconds, does that mean now that an agent is going to have to go investigate that? And I think there are ways that we can craft this system that we can bring the cost of this down significantly. One thing that I've talked about is hiring several people who can always be in this command center, one at all times, to make those judgment calls as to whether authorities or the release agent needs to be notified if somebody's there maybe for 10 minutes or 5 minutes. But nonetheless, there is a cost. No matter what, this is going to be a cost, and I would suspect it will be at least a few million dollars a year. I don't think there's any greater obligation of government than to protect our citizens from violent criminals, especially our little kids. So if there is a place that we ought to be spending money, to me this is it. And I think this would be, while certainly not a cure-all, it would be a very useful tool in keeping track of people who may recommit an offense. Bottom line for me, if we are going to let these guys out of jail, then I want to know where they are every hour of every day until they're no longer considered a threat to society, which for many of these guys probably means till they die. But as a father of two little boys, I kind of like that. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill. If I can mention one other thing, I recognize that even if we do bring the cost of this down, that may be problematic this year, and that there may not be the funding for this. I will advocate for it, but it might not be there. And I have been talking with both the City of St. Paul and with Mr. Eric Lippman from the Department of Corrections about a possible way to turn this into a little bit more of a pilot project, and that is to deal with specifically homeless offenders and require GPS tracking for certain homeless offenders. There are some details that we would still need to work through that, but I would like to, as we consider this for possible inclusion, maybe offer that alternative up if the money's not there.
Representative Johnson, would you be able to get to us that language by March 30?
Absolutely. I can do it in the next few days.
Do so, and then we'll have it here for the committee to consider by the time we get back to the bill, which I am now, unless there are questions, by the way. Are there any questions from the committee? Chair will lay the bill on the table for possible inclusion. Representative Johnson, stay at the table. You have the next bill before us, referencing predatory offenders, adding them to the state website. I believe that's next, and I also see two listed witnesses, Rick Anderson, National Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, and Tim O'Malley, Assistant Superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Is there anyone in the audience whose name I have not just read who wants to be heard on this bill? Raise your hand now. Okay, Representative Johnson, you're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And actually, I think Mr. Anderson and Mr. O'Malley just were mistaken. They are going to be here to testify on my bill tomorrow. So they are not here today.
I stand corrected.
Mr. Chairman, I will move this bill as well for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And this is very simple. Right now, there is a requirement that the Department of Corrections... I need that as well, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry.
Hang on.
I have another amendment, Mr. Chairman. As soon as I get it, I will move it.
All right.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the H3485A1 amendment to put the bill into the form that I would like.
On that issue, any discussion? If not, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 3485 as amended. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that's just a blank appropriation. We have requested a fiscal note, but we don't know what I don't think the cost will be much, but there may be a cost to this. And right now, Level 3 sex offenders are required to be listed on the Internet by the Department of Corrections. This would simply extend that to Level 2 offenders as well. We had talked about possibly extending it to Level 1 offenders, but I thought let's try Level 2. Let's see if it's workable. Let's see how expensive that is.
Yes.
And we can maybe revisit this issue again next year or in future years. As you probably all know, level 3 offenders are considered a high risk to the public, and level 2 offenders are considered a moderate or medium risk to the public, and my thought is that it is only useful to provide them with that information as well if they're still considered a moderate risk.
Any questions? Representative Ellison.
Representative Johnson, in terms of the level 2 sex offenders, what category of sex offenses in that chapter are we talking about? For example, I know that the level ones we're generally talking about violent penetration, right, stuff like that. What are we talking about in terms of the level twos? I probably should know it, but I'm not precise on it right now.
Representative,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, if I could ask Mr. Lippman to come forward, he can answer all these questions probably better than I can.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Eric Lippman, the State Sex Offender Policy Coordinator. Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, it's actually a wide range of offenses. The concept of the risk assessment is a blending of different concepts. The shorthand is likelihood of reoffense, but it actually is a broader concept because it also includes both the severity of the offense in the screening instrument and also a little bit of the range of useful community notification. The risk assessments are done because we're trying to both guard against reoffense and to notify potential victim pools of the threats that may well be apprised against them. So while we frequently see in the media, a level 3 is highly likely to reoffend, there are these other blended elements as we do the evaluation with the actuarial instruments and also the very talented folks at the Department of Corrections that we have making these assessments. It does also incorporate these other types of content. So you may well have folks with, who are non-penetration offenders, but who are at a high risk to reoffend and also have a very wide victim pool. And so that there may well be community notification and a designation higher than a raw sentencing guidelines type severity of the offense assessment. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It does make sense. Is the willingness to participate in sex offender treatment a part of the calculus in determination of who's a level 2 sex offender?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, it is a risk factor that is assessed. So if you drum out of treatment or you flat out refuse, that makes you at a higher risk.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
So I guess my question is, with the level 3s, I actually think there's a merit to your bill, Representative Johnson. With some of the level 2s, I agree. But if somebody's making a good faith strike at sex offender rehabilitation, I would have a certain amount of reluctance to want to put them on the web like that because I think it might undermine their rehabilitation. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison.
Representative Johnson.
I appreciate that. I guess my thought is, when we hear some of the stories and you read some of the news stories, if I'm going to err on one side, I'm going to err on the side of public safety with respect to these folks. Oh. And I see where you're coming from.
But Mr. Chair, rehabilitation is public safety. If the person doesn't do it again, that makes us safe. My question is, do you think that what is the impact of a level 2 who is participating in sex offender rehabilitation? What impact will that have? Will putting their face and picture and info on the web have on the rehabilitation? Do you have any thoughts on that? Or maybe Mr. Lippman has some thoughts because he's well schooled in this area.
If I can answer first, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I don't know. I don't know that it would make that much difference because I would think maybe they'd even have more incentive now to take the treatment and try to get on with their lives in one way or another. But maybe Representative Lippman has a different thought.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I think that the rationale behind the Internet posting is as a supplement to the kind of notification purposes that we do with level 2s right now, which is we're focusing on getting the word out to schools and daycares, and maybe the Internet might well be a useful tool in that regard. That's the policy decision presented to the committee.
Very good. If there's no further questions, That would bring us to conclusion. Do you have a wrap-up, or can I, Chair, just lay it over?
You can lay it over. That's
Chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion
thank
in our
you.
Omnibus bill. Thank you both. Representative Atkins, House File 2700, risk assessment required for all the offenders. If you have witnesses, bring them with you, if you will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding from Mr. Gilley is that there is a person that's here to testify. Chief Mesrick sends his support of the bill, but in view of the time, I told him session starts in half an hour, and he just sent his support for the bill, said it's a good tool for law enforcement.
Are you Mr. Nichols, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, then I do have you listed. Mike Nichols, Hennepin County Community Corrections. Anyone else present in this room wanting to be heard on this bill, please raise your hand. I don't see anyone. Gentlemen, Representative Atkins, proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members, thank you very much for hearing this bill. This bill is designed to continue the intent of the original legislation that was passed some years ago to let folks know when they've got dangerous offenders in their neighborhood. Unfortunately, folks are kind of lulled into a false sense of security with our community notification and risk assessment law. They think that if somebody dangerous moves into their neighborhood, they'll know about it. That's not necessarily the case, because 60%, literally three out of every five offenders, is not required to undergo a risk assessment. That's because they are given probation. They're sentenced to probation rather than sent to prison. Now, you might think that just because somebody gets probation rather than prison, that means that they don't present a danger. Unfortunately, that's not quite the case. What happens sometimes, these offenders are the ones that are, I suppose you could say, fortunate enough to have offended against someone that they know. Perhaps a family member, a neighbor, a child who is reluctant or perhaps too intimidated to actively assist or participate in the prosecution. Not that they wouldn't want to, but it just doesn't work out that way, or they're too reluctant or intimidated to do that. So they end up with a probationary sentence. As a result, they don't undergo a risk assessment. As a result, there is no community notification that's required. The purpose of this bill is simply to ask that those offenders that are sentenced to probation do undergo a risk assessment, and if they are assigned a level 1, 2, or 3, that the community notification that would follow accordingly if they had been sentenced to prison follows if they are given probation. I have talked to many folks in the industry, and I'm sitting next to one now that folks that know what's happening on the ground. I am not aware of scientific data to show that these folks present a danger, but I know of three anecdotal instances where folks were given, offenders were given probation, and in all three instances, it was because they offended against somebody that they knew, exactly the scenario that I described to you. They then went on to reoffend, and all three of those were later given a level 3 assessment. So we're talking about the sort of thing that isn't just theory, that actually does happen. I left my audiovisual stuff and charts and graphs back in my office, but there is one that I would describe to you, which shows the folks that fall into this category are all over the place. It's not just that they're in Ramsey or Hennepin County. They're all over the state of Minnesota. And all I'm asking is simply that they undergo a risk assessment and that neighbors and communities be notified if they move into their neighborhoods.
Very good. Mr. Nichols, did you want to add anything? Or let's tell you what, at this point, any questions from the committee? At this, Representative Ellison, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, when somebody charged with a sex offense and goes through they usually have either a PSI, which is a pre-sentence investigation, or in Hennepin here, there's a pre-plea investigation. But in both cases, I think the statutes require that they have a psychosexual evaluation. I'm pretty certain of that. That's my experience. Now, in the course of that, if the court ultimately determines they're going to be probation, is there a risk assessment in the process of their sentencing that the judge makes? Does that happen, or maybe a witness knows that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison. I'll bet my witnesses or witness probably knows it more on a first-hand basis than I do. But, yeah, there is evaluation that is performed with respect to all of those folks, but it's not the risk assessment that defines it as a level 1, 2, or 3, and therefore no community notification is required.
If I might answer that, there is
a risk assessment. State your name for the audio.
Sorry, Michael Nichols from Hennepin County Probation. I'm the supervisor of the sex offender unit in Hennepin County. Representative Ellison, there is a psychosexual evaluation done, and within that evaluation there is a risk assessment done. The risk assessment basically is used for our purposes to give us some kind of idea of where the offender stands as far as risk goes, and also whether or not they may be amenable to probation, whereupon we will recommend probation if they are. At that point,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Ellison,
is there a but I guess the point that Representative Atkins is making is that you do the psychosexual evaluation and you do a risk assessment, but you don't assign the 1, 2, or 3 category to the person. That's what I'm assuming that you're. So I guess here's my question: do we have level threes or even twos getting probationary sentences?
Mr. Nichols.
Representative, committee.
We may have a level 2 or 3 getting probation, but not on the initial sex offense. They may come back later on another charge unrelated to a sex offense after they've done with probation or parole, no longer under any jurisdiction. If I might comment, I think that reading the legislative bill, the proposed bill, they talk about doing this risk assessment or this review committee or for probationers 90 days before the probation expires. My assumption is that if we have someone on probation and they get to that point of 90 days before they expire, they've done several things that I would say lower their risk. They've completed treatment anywhere from 18 to 24 months. They've completed aftercare anywhere from 12 months to maybe 2 years. In Hennepin County, they've completed our group supervision for 2 years. So we're getting to that point where, you know, 90 days before they expire, if they haven't reoffended or violated probation within that period of time, then my opinion is that the chances of them reoffending as well, the risk level would be low after their probation period has expired.
Last question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Would it be of assistance to the work that you do for these persons to get a 1, 2, or 3 designation just to keep track of them? And then also, would it be difficult for it to do it within the process that already exists? Because at this point, it's done by a DOC committee, I think. Do you have it within the probationary system to just use that 1, 2, or 3 criteria and assign it?
Mr. Nichols.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we do not have that within the probationary system right now to assign risk levels. In this situation, because there is only 90 days left of there before they expires, we wouldn't have any jurisdiction after that 90 days. Their probation would expire. We would have no, they wouldn't be under any more court supervision at that point. Unless there's something that implies that they would be supervised or monitored beyond that time, we wouldn't have any more, you know, as far as interacting with that offender, we wouldn't have any more interaction with them.
Mr. Chair, what's the typical length of probation?
Mr. Nichols, and that was now that's your second to the last question. Go right ahead. Go right ahead.
The typical length of probation is anywhere from 0 to 20 years. And I say typically it's like between 10 to 15 years that we would give an offender probation.
Representative Cornick.
Representative Atkins, we've got an individual in my area that was never convicted of a sexual offense. However, he was convicted of kidnapping. and had this elderly man, and while he was being held in jail, they discovered that he was writing about violent sexual fantasies with minors, attempting to contact minors by the mail, and when he got out, in between times, he was approaching houses, posing as a worker for a youth group, trying to get youth to come along with him to meetings. So he was never convicted of a sex offense, and so the state had a real hard time. They didn't have a sexual classification, so they had to dance around and be careful what they said. We finally had a town meeting, but there was only so far they could go in the notification. Now he's threatening to sue him because he never had a sexual classification or convicted of a sex offense, even though he's really out there. Would this help? This bill, would this allow DOC to classify him, actually put a classification on him? In this case, where he wouldn't be able to run around at will, and where they've got him living now, a block from daycare?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I believe it would. I should pass along my appreciation to the Department of Corrections and Public Safety, who I visited with, and the goal is to work with, as opposed to impose upon, our DOC folks and public safety folks. We had that discussion about how far this bill is going to go. And one thing for the chair's sake and the sake of the committee, I know that there's budget constraints as well. I'm not unmindful of the fact that there's expenses that come along with this. This bill is scalable in terms of what we would implement and when we would implement it. And it's important for me as well as for the DPS and DOC folks to hear that in terms of who do we want, what do we want the output of this bill to be. I think we've identified a key issue, which is that we've got a whole lot of folks. There's kind of this false sense of security that if you haven't gotten a notification about that fellow, for example, or others, that everything is safe in your neighborhood. And that's not quite the case. So what I'm trying to get is a sense for what would be the best bang for the buck. And that would certainly strike me as a situation where I'd want people to know.
Mr. Nichols, surely.
Representative. Part of what we do now, if we have a sex offender who comes to court and there's a presumptive commit on their probationary or on their offense, assuming they would go to prison if they were convicted, and if there is a dispositional departure in that case and they come to probation, we do notify law enforcement of that dispositional departure, and law enforcement in turn will notify the appropriate people in the community. I think they kind of do like a level 2 type notification of people in the community. So in that situation, I'm assuming that with kidnapping, I don't have the guidelines in front of me, but I'm assuming that might be a presumptive commit, at which point, if he had a dispositional departure, then we would make the necessary precautions to notify the necessary people.
Mm-hmm. Representative Cornish.
Well, they got halfway there, and they did a pretty good job. But they classified him as a predatory offender, but not a sexual offender, and they didn't give him the classification because they said they couldn't. They were able to go a certain way with the notification so far, but there was lacking a sexual classification, which we wanted because of all the violent tendencies in the past history. So if this bill would help that, or a classification, even though you don't have a conviction, there was a lot of deviant behavior that was sent out a real warning signal. So.
Anything other than Representative Haymark?
Representative Atkins, I was just reviewing the fiscal note, and maybe I just don't understand it, but it seems like there's significant local government costs to your bill for law enforcement, for community meeting, notification meetings, local victim services, local correction agencies, but nowhere do I see how local units of government are going to be paid for doing this work if your bill was to become law. Unless I don't see where it is. Can you show me?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haymark, that's an excellent point. What was requested of the fiscal note, and I don't know if this would be the best fiscal term, but kind of the worst case scenario, if we implemented it, with every conceivable bell and whistle, it could be required retroactively, prospectively, so that we could see the greatest amount of cost that would be passed along. My intent in this is not to just pass along another unfunded mandate to local government. My hope, though, is that, and my understanding is that this would be potentially laid over, assuming things go okay here today, for potential inclusion, would be to work with our Department of Corrections, Department of Public Safety, and local folks to talk about how best to implement it so that it is not an undue burden, but rather a better tool for law enforcement, better tool for communities. And I am very open to working with the chair, the members of the committee, and the departments in trying to figure out something that fits within the budget and is effective in terms of carrying out the purpose of the bill.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Paymar, did that answer your question?
No, it's fine.
I thought that was pretty good.
The part about having some time to work out some of these issues
that helps
does exist. And we have Representative Newman. Did you have additional questioning?
No, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on this? Chair's going to.
Just Nicholas. One more comment.
Excuse me.
Chair.
Go ahead, sir.
Just wanted to give you some idea of the numbers in Hennepin County that this would affect. We have currently 2,700 sex offenders that are on probation and are not required to have a level assignment at this point. At this time, so when you're talking about appropriations and funding, then that the impact that would have on us would be tremendous.
Mr. Chair, now I have.
See what you did, Mr. Nichols. All right, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, or to the witness. We've got 2,700 in Hennepin County alone. How many do you have in Hennepin County? Or the state of Minnesota, for that matter, on an annual basis, that receive probation and are falling below the radar?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, I believe that former Representative Lippman knows that number, or Ms. O'Neill from the department.
Director Lippman, have a seat. See how quickly you can give us that number.
Mr. Chairman, members, it's my understanding that there are 10,000 offenders still under supervision for criminal sexual conduct crimes or others. So that would be obliged to register as predatory offenders in Minnesota presently. So that gives you the order of magnitude of both prospectively and retrospectively.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lippman, any idea on an annual basis how many we're getting in addition to the 10,000?
It's 1,600 range.
Yeah.
My ballpark guess, this is just, you know, without the ability of having the census report that's on the DOC website, but it's in the 1,600 range, I would think.
Statewide.
Thank you. That's just a gap I'd like to be able to confirm if I could.
Very good. Thank you. Any other questions? If not, thank you, Representative Atkins. There's time. Mr. Nichols, you too. Well, Chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. My apologies to the Department of Corrections, but your portion, we do have maybe a few minutes left. However, I don't want you to be pressed for time in your presentation on deficiency requests. We have time to hear them. We will hear them at the earliest time next week. Thank you for sitting through this meeting. We're going to let our committee out of here now because we do have session in a few minutes. My apologies to the DOC, but we're going to adjourn at this time. The committee is adjourned.